You may not remember the battle at the hot gates of Thermopylae, but you should. You may have heard of the Battle of Marathon, only because of the races, some people are still crazy enough to try to run that takes its name from that. The Battle of Marathon was the result of the Athenians, the people of Athens, heeding the call of a group of Northern Turkey, we would say today, Asia Minor, distant cousins, when they said, "Help us rebel against Darius, king of Persia." Darius, not the Mede, this is Darius the Great, who took over after the death of Cyrus, king of Persia, a man whose name will be mentioned again in our Old Testament series. Darius, whether or not he killed Cyrus's son, takes over and becomes, they called him the shopkeeper because he ran things with such efficiency. And yet, there's this rebellion that takes place up in the north, as Persia, of course, is south of what northern Turkey would be. And it doesn't get very far. But he doesn't like the fact that these Athenians, these Greeks, who he doesn't rule over, came and helped. And so he hires a guy for a new job. His job is to stand beside Darius every night at dinner. And at some point, unexpected, it can't be when he expects it, at some point he is to interrupt him right before a bite and say, "Remember the Athenians. Remember the Athenians." So that he would be frustrated and not forget that someday he would go make them pay. And at some point, he sends Persian armies to Greece, and they land and make their way and think they're going to get there, but there's this battle at a place called Marathon, where they are unprepared for the phalanx formations, perhaps the spears. Scholars debate about why the Athenians and the other Greeks won that day, but the Persians lose. Well, Darius intends to go back in greater strength and numbers, but unfortunately, before he can do that, he dies. After him, his son takes his throne. His son, whose name you ought to know, but you may not know. His name is Xerxes. Xerxes. And the story of Xerxes taking up the mantle of his father to invade Greece and punish the Athenians is perhaps, at least to my generation, one of the most famous stories of ancient history, the Battle of Thermopylae, the Hot Gates. It was made famous because a very clever comic book artist, one known for his work with the Dark Knight Batman series, took up the story and wrote it as a graphic novel, a single book, and won tremendous acclaim. Same guy also did the Watchmen series. You'll hear about a new Watchmen HBO series coming out this year. Same original source. This graphic novel called 300 ends up becoming a movie as well. So if you really enjoy blood and guts and odd cinematography, you can check it out. It's not a bad movie. It's intense. But it tells this story, and it's hard not to be captured by it, because it's the story of a single individual and a small group standing in the breach and being willing to die so that others might be saved. It goes something like this. Xerxes brings his entire army from Persia, which Persia is the greatest empire that there is. It is from India to Ethiopia. Does he have elephants with him? Maybe. That kind of thing. It is said that when their archers would line up and shoot at the opposing armies, they had so many arrows fly in a single volley that it would blot out the sun for 15 seconds or so. And the historians don't call that a lie. There were enough arrows shot at once to do it. That's how big this group is. And he brings that force against Greece, and they land on the shore and make their way toward a pass by which they will enter the heartland of Greece and ransack the entire area. Greece is made up of city-states. They're not even really that united. But when they get to that pass, this place called Thermopylae or the Hot Gates, they find something a little unexpected. See, the Hot Gates were not too much wider, perhaps, than this space here on the inner side of the sanctuary. Maybe a little more than that. and it went for quite a ways, and the cliffs were quite high. And so they were really surprised to find an army waiting for them right there, shoulder to shoulder, shields up, phalanx formation blocking the pass. More so, they were surprised that there were only 300 men there. Now, the historians say maybe it was 800. What they know for sure is it wasn't a lot compared to the massive host of Xerxes' army. The rest of the armies of Greece and all the people were fleeing. They were running, cows and children in tow, getting away, so that when these men died, and they knew they would, well, they would have a chance to rally and be safe. And these men held that pass for 3 days. 3 days. Led by King Leonidas of Sparta. And what can you make of the stories? How much of it is myth? How much of it is not? Is true? It's hard to say. They were there and they held the pass. We know that. How good a man was Leonidas? Did he stand up to Xerxes and challenge him in the name of Western republicanism? I don't know. I do like the line that still comes down to us when Xerxes shouted, "Throw down your spears." Leonidas replied, "Come and take them." And to this day, "come and take them" is the motto of the Greek army, the motto of many Texans, Second Amendment rights, and all these things. In any case, they are betrayed eventually by one of their own. There's a pass that is found. They're attacked from the rear. They lose. The armies of Xerxes, victorious over even the greatest king of Greece, enters into the central lands and quickly conquers Athens, but nobody's there. And at the same time, many of that army and other warriors have made their way to a fleet which engages in battle with some of Xerxes' fleet elsewhere and wins. And Xerxes is then forced to pull back. He now has lost some of his supply chain. He has to leave the territories, but I'm not really going to lose. So he puts a general in charge. "You'll finish this up. I'm going to head home." It doesn't go so well. In a battle called Salamis, Persia is defeated once and for all, and they never are able to take Greece. It will be 100 years before Alexander the Great puts an end to Persia. And Xerxes isn't a bad king the whole way through, nor does he have only bad descendants. Persia does well, but it's a turning point. It's a turning point in their history. As one group of people died, that others might live. That should be all the more interesting when you turn to the book of Esther. And it says, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus," and you think, who on earth is Ahasuerus? And you do a little Google search, and you find out it's just the Hebrew way of pronouncing Ahasuerus. It's just Xerxes. In the days of Xerxes, the one who reigned from India to Ethiopia over all of Persia, when his royal throne was in Susa, or as Herodotus, the great historian, tells us, Shushan, who happened to have a guy in his own annals who was one of his counselors named Marduka, which could also sound a whole lot like Mordecai. It should kind of pique your interest a little that it's the same guy. The Battle of Marathon was 490 B.C. The Battle of Thermopylae, the hot gates, was 480 B.C. Well, Esther tells us in the days of the reign of Ahasuerus, Xerxes, in the third year of his reign, that would be 482 B.C. 2 years before the hot gates, he gave a feast for all his officials and his army. A feast that lasts 180 days. That's half a year. And how long does it take to move an entire army that can blot out the sun with arrows from Persia to the shores of Greece? It's almost like this feast is preparation for the army to marshal and head directly to Greece. I'm not going to say almost. I'm going to say it is. He has a feast to get ready to go and remember the Athenians. And on the seventh day of this feast, when he is merry with wine, by the way, Herodotus also tells us that Xerxes had a penchant for women and wine, things that will be important in our story. When he is merry with wine, he wants to look at his beautiful wife, Queen Vashti, who we know very little about. But we know he liked women and wine, so we can imagine that when she is not happy with him, there may be good reason. And she says, no, I'm not going to come parade in front of your generals in scanty clothing. Forget it, Xerxes, I'm staying home tonight. And he says, I don't like this. There's no way I'm going to let this happen. But what should I do? And his friends say, why don't you make your harem bigger? Let all the beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the young women who please the king be queen instead of Vashti. Why didn't I think of this myself? Let it be so, he says. And then, well, the story keeps going fast, but history has a pause. You can imagine if you had a kingdom from India to Ethiopia, and you wanted to have a Miss Persia contest, that to get someone from one of the 127 provinces would take a little while and a little preparation. And I got to remember the Athenians. So you know what? I'm going to put this guy Hegai, not from the Bible, I'm going to put him in charge, go beat up the Greeks, come back, and I'll have 127 virgins waiting for me. So something like that happens, and off he goes to fight the Greeks. In the meantime, there's a guy in Susa, in the citadel. So he works at the king's palace in some way. His name is Mordecai. He's not famous yet. And he has a niece named Hadassah. Hadassah, who we now call Esther. I don't know why the name change happens there, but her given name is Hadassah. Her father and mother have died, and Mordecai, her uncle, has taken her in. We are told that she is beautiful. Now, what does that mean? I don't know. Tastes change in various cultures, but certainly she's well known enough that when Hegai goes out to find women of every possible make and model, as it were, they take Esther and they bring her into the king's palace, and Hegai has charge of all these women getting ready for the pageant. And for whatever reason, this guy, he's got to be a eunuch. You don't get put in charge of the virgins of the king if you're not a eunuch. Kids, if you don't know, ask your parents later. But eunuchs can't have favorite girls because it's good for them. Doesn't work that way. But he likes Esther. He likes her so much he gives her the best. She gets the best makeup, she gets the best food, she gets the best room, the best of everything. And very quickly, not only is she already quite beautiful, no one can compare to her walking around the halls. Now there's a little echo here of a story we heard last week of Daniel, who enters the Babylonian world and very quickly rises to the top by one of the servants being willing to let him eat the food he wants to eat. Here also, we have a similar thing. God watching out for his people in their exile. Really the point of the entire story. In any case, she's very beautiful, but she has not made known to him or others that she is a Jew. Now, 2 years later, 479, Xerxes comes back. Has he heard about the Battle of Salamis yet? Probably not, but it's somewhere in there. Is his tail really between his legs? Is he completely distraught? Oh, my empire, it'll never be the way it should be. I don't know. But women and wine, well, that's the pagan way of easing the pain, is it not? So the pageant happens. And they're all brought into him one at a time. And when he sees Esther, he will not have another. He puts the crown upon her head instead of Vashti's, grants a remission of taxes, that's a nice thing, and gives gifts to many. Now, it doesn't mean the other ladies didn't become part of the harem, mind you, but it does mean that Esther has now been set at the highest place in the kingdom a woman can, not unlike Daniel, who Daniel by now is probably dead, but just barely so. And under Cyrus, who I mentioned before, two kings back, he was still one of the leading men of the kingdom. In any case, sometime later, we got about a 6-year block that's going to jump ahead here. Somewhere in there, Xerxes decides he's got this new guy, he's doing pretty well, he wants to put him in charge of a lot of stuff. This guy's name is Haman the Agagite. And Agagites, I mean, you don't really know that one, right? What's an Agagite? But you do. The Agagites are the sons of Agag, okay? They are more commonly known as the Amalekites. That one should ring a bell. the Amalekites. These are those who dwelt in the land of Canaan with the Canaanites, whom the people of Israel were to go in and devote to fire, completely slaughtering them and all their stuff. And they didn't. They just killed a lot of them, but not all of them. Which means that these Amalekites, for the rest of history, might just have, would you call it a chip on the shoulder? I mean, if you knew there was a nation that had murdered most of us and then left 100 years ago, you wouldn't really look at them as your favorite friends, right? So when he gets promoted to this level and he's parading about Shusha in his new robes of the right hand of the king, and there's this guy who won't bow down to him, and he's one of them, well then, you can imagine the rage he feels at that. Takes him a while, but he figures out a plan. He saves up quite a bit of money. He goes to the king at some point, maybe when he's deep in his cups, and he says, look, king, there's this group of people that you have. You conquered them way, way back. They're weird. They dress weird. They act weird. They talk weird. They worship weird. I think they affect the economy in a negative way. So here's my idea. What if we just set a day in the future where anybody who wants their stuff can kill them and take it, and they don't get in trouble. Just one day. What do you think? And I'll pay a 10,000 silver talents to make it happen. I mean, is it more than a year's wages? It's a lifetime of work, right? Tons of money. Here's $1 million too. And king raises a toast. I can use the money. I don't know who these people are. No problem. Let's do it. The date is set. Now, the timing of this is interesting, and it's hard to get there too narrowly. But it's somewhere around what we would call the turn of the year. So remember, we're in BC. So we've gone from 42 to 479 to 474. The date is set, but the date is in 473. So it's at least months ahead. And there's a little background story to this, which is interesting. This comes out of Jewish tradition, so give or take, how true, I don't know, but it makes sense that Haman was really concerned about making this go well. I mean, he hated these guys. And so he consulted a few sorcerers, necromancers, mediums, those kinds of things to try to get the auspicious reading. And to do that, they want to have it be on the right date. They want the stars aligned for the mass murder of the Jews. And they try several times. So they're casting lots, and it won't line up good. And it never really does. The lots won't fall in his favor, but they end up kind of almost being in his favor. He picks that date. That's the date that comes to the king. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it will connect to the festival of Purim, which is how the Hebrews remember this event to this day. We'll come back to that. In any case, the date is set. It's in the future. They send out messengers to the entire kingdom, again, India to Ethiopia, saying on this date you can kill Jews, take the stuff. Sounds great. Party for all except them, but oh well. Mordecai gets a copy of this, and he rips his clothing, puts on bags of sackcloth, wanders through the streets wailing until he gets to as close as he can get to his workplace. They know this guy. He's out there screaming on the ground and wailing, and someone's like, that's Esther's uncle. Esther, what's he doing down there? And she sends her messenger, her kind of attendant eunuch, down to him. What's going on? He takes a copy of the thing, kill all the Jews, sends it back up with this message. Will you please go into the king and beg his favor lest this action be taken upon all of us? She takes a deep breath. Well, that's dangerous. Because Mordecai should know this, but she reminds him, and the author reminds us, that would be okay if this was like a modern marriage where you lived in the same house, right? It's dinner time. I'm doing dishes. He comes through. Hey, you know. But it's not this. These guys thought they were gods. And they controlled their time in such a way that you didn't get to just see them, even if you were their queen. And the law was that anybody who walked into his throne room to try to talk to him without being invited there first was killed. Not maybe killed. You're killed. We kill you now. That was dumb. That's it. Now, because that's a little bit dangerous, there is a loophole where the king on his mighty throne can decide, whoa, I like that one just a little bit, so I'll extend my golden scepter and you can crawl on your face, looking the ground the whole way to my scepter and touch it, and then I'll talk to you. And you can wait until I talk to you. So Mordecai, don't you know that? And he's not been to see me in a month. Like, the only thing we do is the only thing we do, and it's been 30 days. There's this harem. Maybe I'm not really in favor. Maybe I'm just going to die. Mordecai replies, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews, but from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether or not you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this." Now, I didn't spend all that time on Thermopylae and the hot gates for no reason. As one king and his army went into certain death so that others might live. And I don't think it's an accident that the same king who was the bad guy in that story is the king who now must be stood before, not at a cavern wall with shields, but by a single young woman. And she has to go and give her life that others might live. And yet where Xerxes is able to overcome the men of Sparta, here, the single Hebrew girl prevails. There's something to this, and the connection of our religion to the real history of this planet. Mordecai's confession to her is also glorious. It is probably the best thing in the book. First, he scolds her, right? "What? You think you're going to hide from the judgment that's coming against the whole world, but to us particularly right now? I'm sorry, that won't happen. But I do know this, that it is from Judah that a son of David must arise to sit on the throne in Jerusalem to be the fulfillment of the promises given to Eve, that a man born of woman would crush the devil's head and so restore all the earth back to the paradise from whence we fell. And since that is the word of God, and since it is true and cannot be undone, there is no way that every Jew can be killed. Not right then. Can't happen. So Esther, you think you're going to get out of from under God here? You're not, but the Jews will. And yet if you abandon your faith now, if you choose your life now over your faith, you won't be spared when the salvation comes. And then how do you not know? This is your time. This is what you were born for. And you can take that either way. You were born to stand in the breach and stop the death that would come, or you were born to die and let the death come. But in that death, either way, to make the good confession that you're going to rise from the dead, that the king of the world is really your God, and that no matter what you see, salvation's already yours in the Messiah. We know for certain she was there for this time, and we know for certain you are here for it as well. Now, the evangelicals, when they preach this bit, it's all about your best life. Such a time as this. Go out, live, have purpose, do amazing things. I'm all for doing good things. You should do them. Do good things. But don't miss that this is not about how you're going to go out and start your business, or how you're going to go out and really make a difference in poverty. This is about how you have come to a place where your faith will be tested. All Christians do. All our lives long, the times are here to test our trust that God's promises are sufficient to see us through, and at some point to put our life on the line one way or the other. And again, the promise is that your life is never on the line, but in the wounds of Jesus already. You even get a glimmer of that when, on the third day, Esther puts on her royal robes, gets all dressed up. On the third day, the day that Jesus rises. And the king's in there on his royal throne, a judge filled with strength and might and even a little wrath. And she goes in, she approaches, not unlike Well, the Son of Man approaching the Ancient of Days, not unlike you, the church approaching the Ancient of Days today, his bride coming to him, begging for mercy. And now the tables turn and Xerxes becomes the image of God, extending the scepter of grace that we might rise and live. She touches the scepter. He says, "What do you want? I love you. Anything you want." She says, "Oh, party. I'll throw a feast for you and Haman. You and Haman, party. A couple days now. Yeah?" He says, "Sure, we'll do it." Haman goes out. He's so happy, he builds a giant murder machine to kill Mordecai on. We won't go into the depths of that, but it's a gallows 50 feet high. They get to the party. They have the feast. 2 days in, the king, you would imagine the cup is swaying by this point. "Esther, what do you want?" "I love you." Yeah? "Half my kingdom." When they say half my kingdom, by the way, it really means you ask for anything except for half the kingdom. You ask for anything else, it's yours. "What do you want?" She says, "My people are going to be murdered. We've been sold and we're going to be annihilated like unto a holocaust." And the king, who's been happy drinking, stands up. Enraged. "What are you talking about? My wife? Who's going to kill my wife? Who would dare?" Right? And if there's a sway in his step, that's okay. This is on purpose on Esther's part. She's got him right where she wants him. Because now she points and says, "That guy right there, Haman. Wicked Haman. He has planned this entire thing." And you have to imagine that Haman's face went, well, white or red. Why don't you pick your choice? And there's another tradition that comes out of this. So I think his face was white and his ears were red. But we'll come back to that. Wicked Haman. King storms off to the garden. King comes back a few minutes later. Haman's been begging for his life. Doesn't matter. King says, "Haman, you know that gallows you've been building?" "Yeah." "You're on that now. Off you go." That happens pretty quick. But there's a beautiful thing here too. He says, "Hang him on that." So they hanged Haman. And then the wrath of the king abated. Hang him on that, and then the wrath is gone. Now, how can you not? Maybe you don't. Hang him on that, and then the wrath is abated. Christ, who hung on the tree that the Father might now turn his face back to you in mercy. Just a glimmer, just a glimmer. She falls at his feet. She pleads for him to send another message out through the kingdom. It happens. They send a message that on the day that everyone's allowed to kill the Jews, they're allowed to fight back and kill them. That's fair in love and war, right? And why did they not just repeal it? Because the Persian kings, when they made a law, could not repeal it. They could just put a loophole into it. And that's the way that it was. So that happens. So that in the 12th month, the month of Adar, at the 13th day of the same, the king's command and edict were carried out. On that very day, the Jews gained mastery over those who sought to master them. Mordecai eventually gets made higher up in the king's service, so that again we find him in the annals of Xerxes, king of Persia. And in that capacity, he institutes a celebration day. He creates a holiday for the Jews. And on that day, they are obliged to keep this 14th day of the month of Abar and the 15th too by making feasts and gladness and sending gifts of food to each other and to the poor. And as I said before, we get the day of Purim or Pur from this. And the name of that is the word casting lots, throwing dice. Because remember how Haman was like trying to make it work and it would never work? And then finally it was like, well, okay, I guess that'll do. Well, who is the author of the lots? I'm not saying you should make all your decisions by throwing dice, but when the dice lands, who's the author of that? But God the Lord. And he caught Haman in his own trap. So they remember this, that God is the ruler of all chaos. He is the ruler of order over chaos, that the history of the nations cannot stand against his word. Their celebration's kind of cool. I sort of want to do it. They read the book of Esther aloud publicly, and then anytime anyone hears the name Haman, you're supposed to like yell and jeer and make noise. So they even have noisemakers, these little ratchet rattles that you spin around. You've like seen those at basketball games. So whenever someone says the name, it makes me think of in, if you know Harry Potter, he who must not be named, if you say his name, everybody goes, oh, right? They all freak out. Well, it's like that. only it's a party. So I imagine my little child, hallelujah, running around the house saying Haman just to make us all yell over and over again. Haman, Haman, Haman. We're all screaming. Ah! Right? It's a vast party. And of course, it's not Lent, so they're not quite the pastries we're used to, but they make a pastry on that day called the Ozne Haman, the ears of Haman. I would put red frosting on those if I had them. All of this with plenty of time not left to remind you that no matter where you sit in time, even if it is after the return of Israel back to their land and you're left in the pagan lands, made the harlot, in a sense, of the pagan king, yet God is with you by his promises. And he will not allow for his promises to be made void. Now, those promises of the shadow that we see here have come to pass in Jesus on the cross with all certainty. And yet they also come forward through time to such a time as this by means of the words and sacraments he left us. The words that I preach, but more importantly for you today, the words and sacrament that you will eat and drink. Where this presence of the actual king extends his golden scepter to you. That you might rise and have more than half the kingdom, you get all the kingdom. Because Jesus is the kingdom. And you are his bride, the church. I want to say so much more. It's so good. In the name of Jesus, amen.